Today on the Rising Coaches Podcast.
A coach has to work very hard so that in the minds of the players, we are separating mistakes from failure. They are not the same thing. But many coaches create an environment where players believe that they are the same thing. We have to separate that. Mistakes are not failure. Mistakes are the way forward. This is how we learn, especially in sports.
Thanks for listening to the Rising Coaches Podcast. This is Adam Gordon, and today we are joined by Dr. Timothy Clark. Dr. Clark is an author of four books, soon to be five, as he is about to release his latest book, The Four Stages of Psychological Safety. Dr. Clark has a PhD from Oxford University and was an academic All-American at BYU, where he played football. And has done a lot of work and research on psychology and leadership and leadership structures and how they translate into the current climate, both in sports and in the corporate world. Dr. Clark is the founder and CEO of Lead Factor, which is a consulting and coaching and training organization. And again, they do most of their work in the corporate space, but we asked Dr. Clark to join us and apply what he's learned and what he's researched to sports. It was a really fascinating conversation. I really had to focus. There were a lot of big words being used, but some really, really great stuff that if you're serious about evolving as a leader, a coach, and a communicator, you will absolutely find this interesting. We hope you enjoy. We hope you subscribe to the podcast. Please write us a review. And please follow along with what we are doing at risingcoaches.com. Tim, how are you?
Hey, I'm doing great, Adam. Thanks for having me today.
Oh, thanks so much for joining us. I'm really excited. You've done so much fascinating work on the psychology of coaching and how to deal with people and what triggers them. So I'm excited to jump into this conversation and learn a little bit from you.
Fantastic.
We were just talking, and I thought this would be a good place to start. Obviously, to be a coach, you need to master your sport, and you can spend a lot of time and years really diving into the technical and tactical aspects of what you do. But the other side, and arguably the more important side, is how you interact with the young men that you're trying to lead or the young women, and the actual coaching humans aspect of it. So maybe we can start there.
Sure. Well, I like what you said, Adam. We are actually dealing with humans, and we need to keep that in mind at all times as coaches. Let me tell you a little story to kind of illustrate the point that I want to make. The point, first of all, is that it's one thing to understand your sport. It's something different to understand coaching. Now, they are related and they bleed into each other as skills, but they're not the same. It's not the same skill set. I'll give you an example. So I went to college for 10 years. I played Division I football at Brigham Young, and then I went to the University of Utah for a couple of years and got a master's degree, and then I went on to Oxford University and got a PhD in social science. So what was I training to do? I was training to teach my subject. That's like a coach learning to coach his or her team or her sport. So after 10 years, they put me in a college classroom and they said, go. Now, here's the interesting thing. After 10 years of learning my subject matter, they really didn't teach me how to teach. And this happens all the time. It happens in the teaching profession, and it happens all the time in the coaching profession. So we learn our sport, as you said, the technical aspects, the strategic aspects, everything about the sport, but we never learned how to coach. That's a different skill. And so that's, I think, a little bit of what we want to talk about today. I'll give you an example. So one of the tools that we use with coaching, and by the way, so I'm I work mainly in the corporate arena, and we use the term coaching all the time. As a matter of fact, we say that as a leader, you have two primary levers that you can use in your job as a leader. The first lever is your modeling behavior, your own personal modeling behavior. You lead by example. So that's number one, and it will always be number one. Your modeling behavior sets the tone and creates the terms of engagement, creates the vibe for that working environment. Well, it's the same with coaching. So your modeling behavior is number one. Number two is your coaching skills. So that is the second lever that you have to influence your team, your people. So if you keep that in mind, we use what we call the spectrum of influence. So just think of a spectrum that runs from left to right. On one end of the spectrum, you have the extremes at the end. So at one end, you have coercion, which is based on the principle of force. And then at the other end of that spectrum, you have manipulation, which is based on the principle of deception. Both of those extremes are going to get you in trouble as a coach. So you want to avoid those extremes, because that's what those extremes get you is they get you compliance. But the people, the athletes that you're coaching are going to be frustrated, and you're not going to be able to draw out their full potential and their full discretionary effort. So in the middle of that spectrum is persuasion, legitimate forms of influence. There are many coaches that have never learned that. And so they operate at the end of coercion or the end of manipulation. And we see it, you know, we see it all the time. I had a daughter that played soccer for a long time, and her coaches, one of their primary tools was public shaming. So if the girls didn't do well, or a particular girl didn't do well, they'd call them out in front of everybody else, and they'd engage in public shaming. And they thought it was completely fine. That's the irony, because what happens in coaching and in the corporate world is that in these cultures, we normalize this kind of behavior. It's dysfunctional, but we normalize it and people accept it. So I could go on and on, but I just wanted to start with that distinction, that understanding your sport is a very different thing than understanding the skill and the competence of coaching itself. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And the system, at least in college basketball, is so backwards because, you know, in order to climb the career ladder, so to speak, you have to first do all these support staff jobs. But at the same time, those support staff jobs are limited in what you can do on the court. So you're really never getting any hands-on experience coaching until you finally get that job, and then they just throw you in the deep end and hope you can figure it out on the fly.
So that makes it even harder, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It does. But I wanted to ask you, as you were talking, I was thinking about this. One of the things that you hear all the time is when you were talking about persuasion and that being a really powerful tool for coaches. One of the things you hear all the time is, you know, this generation, and I've been hearing this for 20 years, so I'm sure this narrative has been around a lot longer, but this generation's different. You used to be able to tell kids how it is, tell them the truth, and they just did it. And now these kids need to be convinced that it's in their best interest, or it's the right thing, or that you have their back. Do you buy that? Do you think there's some truth to that, or do you think this is the way it's always been and now we just have some research to prove it?
Well, if you go back and you look at the history of coaching or the history of leadership in the corporate world, it's very much the same, and the evolution is very similar through the years. And so what we have is we have a history, so we have to understand the history. So I hope all the listeners understand the history of coaching and the history of management and organizations. The history is authoritarian. That's our history. We have subscribed for many years since the Industrial Revolution to the leader as oracle. The leader So that means the leader has the answers. The leader is the repository of all answers. So come to the leader, come to the coach, and the coach will tell you what to do and then dispatch you. That is authoritarian at worst, especially if you're pushing the fear button when you do it, or it's paternalistic at the least. That means that you still demonstrate respect and affection for your players, but you're paternalistic. That means that you're not allowing them to really participate as much as they can. You pat them on the head and you tell them not to touch things. In other words, I'll just tell you exactly what to do. So I think what you're seeing, Adam, and we're seeing the exact same thing in the corporate world, is that the new demographics are coming in to organizations and they're coming onto teams, and they're not responding in the same way. And that's a good thing, because we've normalized a lot of coaching behavior that needs to be unlearned. Now, here's another reason that it needs to be unlearned. So let's think about coaching on a continuum. Coaching runs from tell at one end to ask at the other. The traditional American model of coaching, and by the way, it's not just American, it's universal. The traditional model of coaching is a tell model. So I grew up in locker rooms, right? I played defensive end at Brigham Young University and had a good career, 4 years. Well, what kind of coaching did I receive? It was all at the tell end. What does that do? So tell-based coaching, now, of course, there's a time and a place for it, and especially when you're young and you're learning, we've got to do a lot of that. But what happens ultimately is that if you stay at that end of the continuum, it breeds dependency and learned helplessness in the players. Now, that's exactly the opposite of what we're trying to do. What coaching is trying to accomplish, it's trying to transfer ownership and critical thinking to the player. That's what we're trying to do. We're trying to accelerate the development of basketball IQ. Now, there's a lot of things that are not just purely cognitive. You got to go out there and you've got to develop muscle memory, and you've got to develop certain skills that can only come through enormous amounts of repetition. We get that. But where we're struggling is that we're actually blocking the learning of our players because we're camped at the tail end. We're stuck at the tail end, and that's a big problem.
So everybody, you know, there's a big phrase in sports that I'm sure you've heard, is that, you know, everybody wants a player-led team, and those are the teams that end up winning because of what you just talked about, the basketball IQ aspect or whatever your sport, you know, understanding how to make decisions in the moment for yourself and not needing to be told exactly what to do. So everybody, I think, understands that, and they say that they want a player-led team, but what are some strategies to actually create that and provide an atmosphere that allows that?
Right. So I think, Adam, this comes back to the topic of psychological safety, which is the topic of my forthcoming book. So let me define this. So psychological safety means that you can interact with a social unit, so in this case, a basketball team, without feeling embarrassed or marginalized or punished in some way. That's the basic definition. But psychological safety is a little bit more, it runs through a natural progression of stages. And I think this would be helpful for the coaches out there to understand. So the first stage of psychological safety is what we call inclusion safety. And what that means is that you feel included, you feel accepted, you belong, you fit in. That's the basic level of human need that your players are going to be concerned about. So we have to attend to that. And it's also perishable. So you've got to keep that going. You've got to reinforce that. So that's stage one, inclusion safety. We long to belong as humans. Then we go to stage two. Stage two is learning, learner safety. That means that you feel safe in engaging in all aspects of the learning process. And this is what athletes have to do. So they have to ask questions. They have to give and receive feedback. They have to try things. They have to experiment. And then they have to make mistakes. All of those things are critical to their learning and growth and development. But you can see that learner safety creates a little bit more personal risk and a little bit more vulnerability for the athlete. So there's got to be a higher level of psychological safety. How does the coach provide that? The psychological safety is provided based on a combination of two things. Number one, respect. Number two, permission. Those two things come together. So that's the second stage. Then we go to the third stage. The third stage is contributor safety. Contributor safety means that now I feel safe to be able to contribute as a full member of the team, to use my talents and abilities and skills to make a difference, again, without the fear of being embarrassed or humiliated or marginalized. So that's the third stage. And it naturally follows, because as soon as you learn things and you develop new skills and knowledge and abilities, you want to go use them. You want to go apply them. So there's a natural sequence. So contributor safety naturally follows learner safety. But then we get to the highest level. This is where it gets really quite interesting. So the highest level of psychological safety is what we call challenger safety. Now, this is particularly critical in the business world, but I want you to think about the application in the coaching world. Challenger safety means that you feel safe to challenge the status quo. Now, think about that. That's the highest, that puts the individual at the highest level of vulnerability. So that's why we need the highest level of psychological safety. So why would you do that? You need challenger safety to innovate. You need challenger safety to make changes. You need challenger safety to look critically at the way you're doing things and say, you know what, I think I have an idea or a suggestion about how to make things better. In the coaching world, in most cases, this is not allowed. It was never allowed for me as a college football player. In fact, psychological safety overall, in many cases on teams, is very, very low. What coaches really need to understand is that the cognitive development of an athlete is linked to the emotional state of the athlete. They are always interconnected. The emotional and the rational, the intellectual, they go together. That's how athletes learn. Those two processes go together. Same way in the classroom. You can never separate those things. So if at any time the coach pushes the fear button, the coach is not coaching anymore. We're using fear as a proxy for leadership. But whenever you push the fear button, it's an abdication of leadership. You're not coaching anymore. It's just a cop out.
What does the fear button do to people? And is there any value in it, and a time and place for it?
So the fear button freezes discretionary effort. That's what it does. The fear button moves a person into a mode of personal risk management, fear of loss prevention, right? Because they start to freeze, and you don't have their full cognitive capability or emotional capability because they've gone into a mode. See, what it does, it triggers what we call the self-censoring instinct. So think about how dangerous it is for a coach to do this to an athlete. If you trigger that athlete's self-censoring instinct, then he or she is focused on what? Just compliance. Doing what you told him or her to do to make you happy. They're not thinking about anything beyond that now. You've triggered the self-censoring instinct. They are going to retreat and recoil into a mode of compliance and personal risk management. And that's a completely normal response. So the coach has to be able to create accountability, but not trigger the self-censoring instinct at the same time. That's not an easy thing to do, but that's what the coach's role is.
Yeah, I was going to say that seems like a very fine line. Maybe I can give you an example of something really common, and you can tell me how psychologically it may work.
Sure.
You know, for instance, if rebounding and blocking out is really important to you and your program, and you say, for every missed block out in practice, we're going to stop and put everybody on the line and run a suicide. Does it depend on your delivery, whether you're triggering that fear instinct?
It does. It very much depends on your delivery. So here's the first thing that coaches need to pay attention to. So what is their emotional response to mistakes? Because here's what a coach has to do. A coach has to work very hard so that in the minds of the players, we are separating mistakes from failure. They are not the same thing. But many coaches create an environment where players believe that they are the same thing. We have to separate that. Mistakes are not failure. You're going to make mistakes. Mistakes are the way forward. This is how we learn, especially in sports. So we're going to make lots and lots of mistakes. Mistakes should not be linked to punitive consequences. It's not punitive. Now, is it possible to still say, get on the line, we're going to do suicides, we're going to run ladders? It is, but if it's done the right way, because you've got to set the terms of engagement. And so often what we're trying to train athletes to do is to engage in what the research literature calls deliberate practice. That means practicing with complete focus. It's very, very difficult for young people to learn that skill. So they'll go out there and go through the motions. Their bodies are going through the motions physically, but they haven't learned to discipline their cognitive powers to really focus. And so what I would suggest is that coaches talk about this very openly with players and say, look, so one of the things that you've got to learn as a player is you're going to learn really intense focus. Basketball is a game of controlled intensity and intense focus, and it takes a while to learn that. And so if we're not doing well, then we're going to take a little time out. And we're just going to focus and, you know, we're going to run a suicide, but it's not punitive. You see the difference?
Sure.
It's not punitive. What is that going to do? Get on the line and run suicides. Is that going to make you focus more? It may from a compliance standpoint for a minute, but that's not what you're after. You're after long-term development of the capacity to engage in deliberate practice, to engage in controlled intensity, to be able to do that. That's really the goal. And so if they just get on the line and they run suicides, it may not do anything. It may be even counterproductive. And if it's laced with fear, if fear is pervasive in the organization or on the team, in the environment, then it could be very counterproductive.
It's funny. I can see how you say it's so ingrained into our system and the coaching model, because I keep thinking of examples of maybe, and I do think there's some coaches out there who probably operate in this structure and are really effective at it. First of all, there's people really successful doing everything in every different type of way. I think about somebody who may want to change, may want to do something like this, spend time, you know, using the blockout example, explaining and teaching why this is important. And then maybe 10 games in the season, you know, they're 4-6 and they say, you know what? All right, I'm drawing the line. Like, now we're going to go back to like what I've done my whole life, which is we're going to start punishing you for, you know, missed blockouts, not getting the job done.
Yeah. 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 I think that's completely wrong. So think about this. How many coaches are out there that don't have the talent that they wish they had on the team? Well, that happens all the time.
Sure.
So if you don't have the physical specimens, if you don't have the skills, the agility, the height, whatever, what do you do? How do you win games? If you go toe-to-toe on physical dimensions with your opponent and you don't stack up, you don't measure up, the only way that you're going to win is on execution. It's the only way. If you're giving up on skills and physical characteristics, then the only way is on execution. So how do you win on execution then? It goes back to the ability of those players to be able to focus. And how do they learn that? It comes from their ability to engage in deliberate practice in practice. So you just have to trace it back to what would give you the capacity to execute at just a little bit better than the opponent. Well, that's what it comes back to. So punitive consequences are not going to get you there. They're really just not going to get you there. So I think coaches really need to think really, really hard about this. Throughout my entire coaching career, I was on the receiving end of a fear and intimidation style, at least with my position coach. My head coach didn't do that at all, but my position coach did. And then I was on the receiving end of tell coaching. Now, here's something that I would invite all of the listeners to think about. If you look at any sport and you go to a world-class level of performance, watch what happens when a coach interacts with a player. It's absolutely fascinating because the coaching model turns on its head. What happens is, any sport, you watch what happens. So the coach talks to the player. The coach will switch and will usually be operating at the ask end of the coaching continuum, not the tell end. Now, why is that? Well, because he or she is dealing with a world-class athlete. And that athlete is extremely experienced and knowledgeable. Well, that makes sense. But could it be that we should be using that coaching model far earlier in the development of the athlete? My answer would be absolutely yes. We are way too behind. We're so far behind. We're socializing our athletes with a tell model. We should begin with an inquiry-based model to transfer critical thinking, transfer ownership far earlier in the growth and development of the athlete. At least that's my point of view.
Is the corporate world ahead of the athletics world in this?
The corporate world is ahead in one respect and behind in another. So let me begin with the behind. The corporate world is behind in the way that we do real-time coaching, the frequency of coaching. So the corporate world is tied to an annual budget cycle. And so many, many organizations in the corporate world, what have they done? They've adopted a performance review that's annual in nature. Well, that doesn't work because your feedback is stale. Your feedback is irrelevant. It's obsolete at that point. So the corporate world is a delayed model of coaching that doesn't work very well. And the corporate world is frantically trying to catch up and adopt an athletics-based model of real-time coaching at the moment of need, where it's timely, it's targeted, it's relevant, it's actionable right now. But where the corporate world, in my opinion, is moving beyond the athletics world is in creating psychological safety, creating that work environment where the employee or the athlete feels empowered to release discretionary effort, that feels very safe, does not feel threatened in that environment. The corporate world, and this is why, because in the corporate world, we compete based on competitive advantage. That means we have to innovate. If we don't innovate, we die. Well, innovation is based on collaboration. Collaboration is based on creative abrasion and constructive dissent. That means that we have to work together. We have to figure out how to innovate together by rubbing ideas together, by having hard-hitting debate, by having a tolerance for candor. So the corporate world will not survive. Organizations will not survive unless they have created this environment of extremely high psychological safety. Now, I'm not saying that all organizations do this. Of course they don't. But with, for example, a lot of the tech companies that we work with in Silicon Valley, there's an absolute acknowledgement that this has to be in place. So in this case, I think there are many teams in the athletic world that have fallen behind. They're still applying a very antique, outdated, authoritarian model, if that makes sense, Adam.
Sure. Do you have any examples of coaches who are just crushing it in terms of psychological safety and are really displaying this type of environment within their teams that you can think of?
Well, I can think of some around, some local teams at the high school level, where I'm at. the challenge for me is that I can't. So in order to see that, I have to be up close and personal, right? Because it's basically, it's cultural anthropology where you're with them and you see the group dynamics, you see the way that they're interacting, you see the terms of engagement. I do
have some in mind, but, I'll give you an example. So probably the best example, and this is a historical example.
When I was playing college football, our head coach was Lavelle Edwards. He's now a Division I college Hall of Fame coach, and he passed away just a little while ago. But I had the opportunity to play for him for 4 years. He was a master in creating psychological safety. And he had one losing season in 30 years of coaching. Now, here's the amazing part about it, Adam. He had to field teams based on mostly 2- and 3-star recruits. So think about that. So you're recruiting and you're fielding your teams based on 2- and 3-star recruits. And, he won a national championship. He won numerous conference championships, one losing season out of 30. How do you do that? You do that by creating psychological safety and developing your players to execute, to out-execute the competition, because toe-to-toe physically, you're going to give something up. So that would be the biggest example that I lived and breathed, because I never saw Coach Edwards push the fear button. Did we have consequences? Yes, we did. I'll give you an example. So if you came 30 seconds late to a team meeting, the doors were shut and locked and you couldn't come in. But in the way that he personally interacted with the players, he never induced that fear. He just didn't do that. He was extremely kind and engaging, but he was also candid and honest. No head games, no manipulation, but real consequences.
No, that's so great. That's such a great.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's such a great simple example, because you're not sacrificing your standard. You can't sacrifice your standard.
No.
The accountability is there. The door's locked. There's nothing personal.
That's right.
There's no, there's no name calling. There's no blaming. You simply show up. You can't get in the room. You're out of luck.
Yeah.
Such a great, simple thing. The other guys that come to mind for me, and like you said, you don't really know what's behind the curtain. So unless you're around them every day,
right,
you can't be a fair judge on this. But Pete Carroll certainly seems like that type of coach, and they seem like they create that type of environment. I've heard him talk about especially once the game starts, he doesn't waste any time correcting anything that's happened in the past. He's more concerned with it in the moment, and then after they go back and review. But the great example that I can think of, and I don't know how familiar you are with this person, is Jack Clark, the rugby coach. No relation, by the way, between you guys, right?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. He's the rugby coach at Cal. Are you familiar with him at all?
Just a little bit, because Brigham Young usually plays Cal in the national championship.
Okay. Well, he's won, I think, somewhere, let's see, 23 national championships in his career, maybe more, because there's different there's different divisions of rugby. I guess there's 15s and 7s, which I don't really know what that means, but I know he's won a lot. And I heard him in an interview, and he was talking about his process and how their team functions. And they, I guess in rugby, they play on Saturdays, so it's similar to football. And so on Sundays, they have a team meeting, and he asks the team, he's up at the whiteboard, and he's writing down for the team, and the team says, he asks them to identify what they did well in the game. And so he'll write down those things, and that's a collaborative exercise. And then they write down what they need to do better for the next game to succeed. And they spend about an hour as a group coming up with that, and then that is what they base their practice on for that next week on. So it's completely collaborative. I imagine it provides complete psychological safety on all four levels, because not only are they in an environment where they're allowed to challenge or give their opinion, but they're encouraged to.
That's a fantastic example. I actually have another one that I'll give you, and for the listeners out there, you might find this fascinating, because I am pretty aware of the way that this gentleman coaches. So I'll cite the example of Cale Sanderson, who is the head wrestling coach at Penn State. Now, his career and his coaching career are amazing. So this gentleman, so he came out of Iowa State. He had a wrestling career of 159-0. So he was the first Division I collegiate wrestler to never lose. So he never lost. He won four national championships. Then he went on and he won a gold medal in the Olympics. And then he went straight into coaching. He coached for a couple of years as an assistant back at his alma mater at Iowa State. And then they gave him the head job at Penn State. So he's been there, I think, 9 years. He's won 8 national championships in 9 years. So he has established an absolute dynasty. There's really no other active coach in any Division I sport that is as successful as he is. I was able to spend some time with him and interview him and understand his approach. And so you talked about collaboration, Adam. You know what Cale does? It's pretty amazing. He's very understated. He has an incredibly collaborative style. He'll even allow some of the wrestlers to be in charge of aspects of practice, to take on a coaching role, to be in charge. So you take this one, he'll delegate that to them, and then they're in charge. Very collaborative, very empowering, and then he'll get down on the mat and help guys with moves and technique and such. But it's not a fear-based environment at all. It's very collaborative. But as you said, Adam, and I agree with you completely, there are standards and standards of performance, and there's accountability without fear. And I think that's a big challenge for a lot of coaches. But is it possible? Absolutely possible.
I kind of want to revisit the persuasion piece that you talked about earlier,
sure,
with a specific example in mind or two. I think about Mike Krzyzewski at Duke and John Calipari at Kentucky, two of the arguably greatest coaches of all time in basketball.
Yeah.
And those guys coach their kids extremely hard. I mean, Coach K is of the Bobby Knight tree, and he is on those guys. But I think where they're a little bit unique is I think Coach K, and again, this is all just through reading and hearing about it. I haven't been around Duke and I haven't been around Kentucky firsthand. But you read so much and hear so much about Coach K's relationships with his kids, and it all starts with the permission piece. You know, and he starts it with like, do I, you know, like for this to work, like I'm going to need you to give me permission to, you know, ride you, so to speak, or to really get on you hard. And that's always the center of it. And I think Calipari is probably a little different. I don't know. I'm sure those conversations happen as well. But Coach Calipari is such a brilliant salesman, which they all are. Mm-hmm. But to me, he's like the best salesman in America and is constantly selling his kids on the success that he's had putting his players in the NBA, his players going on to be NBA Hall of Famers, making multi-millions of dollars. And so this is what it takes to get to that. And I know that that's your end goal. That's my goal for you. So I'm going to coach you really, really, really hard because that's going to help you get there. So again, it goes back to that, you know, yes, they maybe the fear button's not pressed because this has all been initiated with the permission piece, and then it's constantly that's reminded right. through the sales piece.
Well, I think that's right. So I'll give you – let's talk about Coach K a little bit. So it's interesting because I was on a plane last night coming home from New York, and there were several people in front of me. I could see on their screens they were watching this documentary on Coach K that I've seen before. Now, anyone that's seen the documentary, you'll be able to see that – that what Adam, what you just said is true. And that is that what he does is he fulfills the two requirements of psychological safety. Number one, respect. Number two, permission. Once those are established, then the players are able to handle candor at a completely different level. And why are they able to handle it? Because they feel the underlying psychological safety. They feel the intent of the coach. The intent is that I know that the coach is trying to make me the best player that I can be. I also know that the coach cares about me as a human being and about my character development. If that's in question, then we can't engage at the same intimate level that we need to. I think Coach K is a master of that because he's the real deal. He's authentic. He's genuine. He really does care. And the thing that this documentary brought out is that it went back and they were interviewing many of his players over the years. Guess what? They feel the same way about him today that they did back then. And it's that long-term relationship of trust, very deep trust that they built. And so there's this mutual respect that is lifelong. Well, that has to be real. That cannot be an artificial element. It'll never work. And so you had testimony after testimony from his former players saying, this is the way it was. Was it tough? It was extremely tough, extremely demanding, extremely candid. But I signed up for that. And Coach K, he always performed his end of the bargain. And that's what you see. So it's tough, it's challenging, but the respect's there and the permission's there.
Tim, how are you on time?
I'm doing fine.
Okay.
Doing great.
I want to ask you this. I wonder if you have any research or just thoughts on this. How effective is humor as a tool to disarm or to stay away from that fear button?
Oh, I think it's extremely important because humor is a relief valve. And as we all know, in sports creates and represents intensity. And you can't maintain intensity all the time. And so when performing the sport, practicing the sport, we're always intense. We need that intensity. That's how we focus. That's how we execute. But there's got to be relief from that. So humor is an incredible relief valve. And it's also a way that we express belonging to each other, acceptance to each other, and affection to each other. I think it needs to be an extremely important part of the culture. When I was playing college football, Coach Lavelle Edwards would always use humor. He had comedic timing. He would say just the right thing at the right time to, take the pressure off, to, using it as a relief valve. And we knew, and it also was his way of telling us that he cared. And we knew that, and he did it on a consistent basis. So I think it's essential. Otherwise, you know what? It stops being fun. And that's another thing that we're running into, is just a lot of burnout. And so I think humor is a big part of creating renewal and restoration in the process of participating in a sport.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. The reason I asked, I think about Bill Belichick and Greg Popovich, who, on the surface are two of the most demanding, and without being behind the curtain, and I'm sure they're not like this when you actually are around them, but it seems like if anyone's pressing the fear button, it might be those two. I'm sure you would find that they're not. But they are supposed to be extremely funny, constantly making their teams laugh, cracking a joke at times that you may not expect it. And then I think the other thing, you talk about execution. Those two, and they've talked about it at length, invest in players that they can depend on and will execute at that high level. And that's why, they've been extremely successful, because they've had superstars that are like that, in like Tim Duncan and Tom Brady. But that's why they're not afraid to play guys who maybe don't fit the bill and play them in big moments. You always see this with the Patriots. They'll be in the Super Bowl and they're going to Rex Burkhead, or they're going to, like a guy like Julian Edelman. Those players who maybe on paper aren't off the charts, but extremely dependable. Right. And they always know that they will execute in those moments.
That's right. Yeah, completely agree with that. They're able to take sometimes mediocre physical specimens and turn them into incredible performers because they can execute at a much higher level. I think they accelerate the football IQ in the case of Belichick. I really, really do. When you think of their ability to execute is astonishing. How does that happen? It's the system that he's created. And it goes back to, I think humor is a very important part of that. You got to unstring the bow from time to time, take the tension off and relax a little bit, because we're going to do it again. But you got to enjoy the process. And he's demonstrated the ability to take players and work with them for a long, long time. And those players just keep getting better. And so he definitely believes in long-term investment. So definitely something that he's done.
The book is The Four Stages of Psychological Safety. You can pre-order it right now on Amazon. Great tool if you're in coaching, in the corporate world, and you're interested in creating an environment that will allow your athletes or employees to thrive and feel comfortable enough to really thrive. It's a great book. Anything else we should expect while reading it?
Well, I hope that you'll find it relevant to coaching, and because I think it does apply. And I would just say that coaching is such an incredible profession, such an incredible place to be. And yet we as coaches, we've got to be striving to get better. We've got to be aggressive and self-directed learners ourselves. So I would remind all of the coaches out there that's our part to play in all of this.
Dr. Clark, thank you so much for your time and joining us today, and look forward to reading the book.
Well, thanks, Adam. Appreciate the opportunity to be with you.